Last week, the Boy Scouts of America delayed their decision on whether to change their policy banning openly gay scouts or scout leaders. Today, the case for keeping the ban in place. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week, we heard the argument for the ban to be lifted. Today, the other side of the debate. In the first half hour, former Boy Scout, now president of Patriots for Christ, Craig Bergman of Des Moines, explains why some Iowans are hoping for the status quo on the Boy Scouts ruling. Then in the second half hour, new research on where fear originates in the brain. We'll talk with neuroscientist and psychiatrist Dr. John Wemmy of the University of Iowa. That's all coming up this hour. First, a check of the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the year 2000, the United States Supreme Court said the Boy Scouts of America's ban on openly gay scouts and leaders was legal free speech by a private organization. Last summer, the Boy Scouts of America confirmed this policy. Then, 2 weeks ago, said it was reconsidering the ban. Then, last week, the Boy Scouts announced it would postpone a decision on that until May. That's when approximately 1,400 voting members of the National Council come together at the National Annual Meeting. Last week, the Boy Scouts said in that statement that it had received an outpouring of feedback from the American public. The statement continued, after careful consideration and extensive dialogue within the scouting family, along with comments from those outside the organization, the volunteer officers of the Boy Scouts of America's National Executive Board concluded that due to the complexity of this issue, the organization needs time for a more deliberate review. We reached out to the Boy Scouts of America for some comment on this program, on that delayed ruling. They said they could only send us the official statement from which I just read, and they mentioned that beyond that statement, they don't have any additional information at this time. Well, last week, perhaps you heard on this program, Iowa Eagle Scout and gay rights activist Zach Walls on this program, arguing for the ban to be lifted. Walls is the founder of the national organization Scouts for Equality. Today, we offer you another perspective, one that is against lifting the ban on gays in the Boy Scouts. My guest is Craig Bergman in this first half hour. He's a nationally syndicated radio talk show host of a program called America's Wake Up Call. America's Wake Up Call is a conservative talk show supported by the Tea Party of America. Craig is also president of Patriots for Christ. Patriots for Christ, a conservative Christian group. Craig Bergman has also served as a campaign manager, a senior staff or consulting role for multiple political candidates, including five presidential races. Most recently, Bergman served as Newt Gingrich's Iowa political director. Bergman resigned in late 2011 after calling Mormonism a cult. Perhaps you remember that in the news. Additionally, Craig Bergman has served as a consultant or grassroots organizer for other national organizations, such as Christian Coalition, Focus on the Family, and Americans for Prosperity. Craig is a veteran and was a Boy Scout. He joins us from our studio in Des Moines. Craig Bergman, welcome to our program after a very lengthy introduction. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
I want to reach out to our listeners. Craig is with us for this first half hour, so we want your opinions, your questions for him. Do you agree with the Boy Scouts of America's ban on openly gay scouts and scout leaders? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, we're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's get to the core of the issue. Why would you like to see the Boy Scouts of America keep the ban on gay scouts and scout leaders, Craig?
Well, it comes down to love, Ben. And the whole gay agenda, if I can use the buzzwords from the news media and television, comes across as an issue of love, but it in an Orwellian fashion has been redefined. And so I think because we've lost the meaning of what words mean, we're having this debate, whereas generations before us who had moral certitude and knew what words meant weren't easily confused and led astray.
Mm-hmm. I hear when I talked to Zach Walls last week, you called it the gay agenda. I'm just focusing in on what Zach was emphasizing was the idea of inclusiveness, that we shouldn't rule out any boys based on being homosexual from the scouts. So if we can speak to that specific point, what do you fear would happen if Boy Scouts of America were to take a policy that they allowed openly gay scouts and scout leaders?
Well, I think we have to start once again with the right language and the right words. As you phrased the question, Ben, you said, what do I fear? Nothing. Because the Word of God says God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, then let's strike the word fear and just say, what would happen in your mind? What do you imagine would happen if this policy were changed?
Well, if the policy were changed, what would happen is we would be openly embracing a destructive lifestyle, and that would be unloving.
Mm-hmm. In what way destructive lifestyle?
Well, in the way that it is a reprobate mind that falls victim to that particular sin.
Okay, so this is a matter of faith, because that you're saying here, because science in the meantime, people realize that homosexuality is something that can be traced to our DNA, is something that a person doesn't...
Well, I don't believe that. I believe that science is as bogus as the global warming science.
Okay, so it's not something that is you're born with or not born with.
Well, once again, if you don't have your definition, if you don't have the foundation set, Ben, you can be talking about window dressings and the carpeting and everything. The foundation is, does man have free will? And yes, he does.
Okay.
Now, are there men who are predisposed to certain things? Maybe homosexuality, maybe drinking, maybe a violent temper, maybe timidity. Sure, certainly. Sin is something we're all born with. We're all S-I-N positive.
Okay. Just to be clear, I'm just trying to understand your position, Craig, mm-hmm. and trying to use the most neutral language I can think of.
Sure.
One of the ideas, and let me play you a quote from Zach Walls in the interview I did with him last week. This is a more practical matter when he talks about recruitment. Zach Wall predicting that the Boy Scouts of America would lose fundraising and recruitment efforts. Recruitment efforts will be hurt if the ban on gay and lesbian leaders continues. He also argues that scout law does not include a ban regarding a leader or a scout's sexuality. Let's listen.
It hurts recruitment, it hurts fundraising, it hurts the brand. You know, the idea that scouting serves communities, but only some parts of the community, is something that is very incongruent in a lot of people's minds. So when you think about the scout law, you know, a scout is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, reverent. You'll notice that heterosexual is not in that list.
Okay, not on that list. How do you respond to that, Craig Bergman?
Oh, that's simple. Obedient to whom? God or man? Love, we just had the word in there, trustworthy, reverent to whom? Reverent to immoral lifestyle, reverent to the laws of nature and nature's God.
Well, I think we have lots of different, not only Christian denominations, but lots of different faiths represented in the Boy Scouts of America, don't we?
Oh, I'm sure we do, but I believe that all the faiths and all the doctrines of the faiths of the world understand what sin is, and what repentance is, and what is wrong.
Now, we have
mm-hmm. certain teachers within each of these religions mm-hmm. who have attempted over the years, and this isn't the first time this debate has ever happened in a culture, Paul wrote his letter to the Corinthians because they became a very sexually immoral people, and that's why he had to write this letter. So this isn't the first time this debate has happened. This just happens to be the 21st century and the Boy Scouts. Pick your target.
Okay, let's go to our phones. Joining us this hour, if you've just joined us, Craig Bergman. He's a nationally syndicated radio talk show host of America's Wake Up Call, also a proponent of keeping the ban by the Boy Scouts of America on openly gay scouts and scout leaders. Daniel in Dubuque. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Go ahead, please. Thank you for calling.
Well, we have my wife and I are Catholic, and we live in a fairly medium-sized town, but we live out in the country, and we raise our boys without television, without video games, and we try to just embrace that whole culture of yes, ma'am, no, sir, and giving some chores to kids and keeping them accountable for themselves. And we have These three boys are in Scouts. Our oldest son will just be entering Boy Scouts here next week, and the other two in Cub Scouts. And we have talked about this and absolutely plan on pulling all three boys out of Scouts if they do reverse that decision. That's our opinion on that.
Daniel, let me quickly ask you the same question I asked Craig. What do you imagine happening if you would keep your sons in Scouts and they would have a policy of allowing openly gay Scouts and Scout leaders? What is your sort of scenario that you don't want your sons to be exposed to?
Well, first of all, you know, our main core belief is to keep the kids safe. And I love that they're in Scouts. We hope all three will become Eagle. That's we juggle our schedules and work our homework schedules and all this around.
What about allowing homosexuals in Scouts does not keep any other boys in Scouts safe? What is the unsafe part there?
Sure. I guess if you've ever been on a Scout outing, especially with younger Scouts, there's going to be more and more contact with openly gay or homosexual. We also would play that by ear. So if someone openly gay entered that our troop or in our pack, then we would go ahead and pull the boys out. But we just came back from a winter camp out, and the boys go to the latrine together. They always have to go on the buddy system. They're going to be exposed to that. You know, and it's my personal man and wife, not man and man, and that's the way I feel, that I just really am not interested in having my kids exposed to that. That's coming from someone who's a little old-fashioned in small-town Iowa, you know, going so far as to actually believing that homosexuality is some type of a mental illness or missing a certain chromosome, you know.
Okay, Daniel, I think we got your point. We have limited time, so I'm gonna say thank you for giving us your perspective, Daniel.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Daniel from Dubuque. Craig, back to you. Craig Bergman, what's wrong with letting – what the Boy Scouts of America were considering was letting local chapters decide for themselves whether to admit participation by openly gay people. Usually conservatives are in favor of local decision-making, at a local level, but not in this case.
Well, no. Once again, you've missed the foundation. You got your house sitting about 3 feet out past the foundation there. What we're in favor of is absolute moral truth. Then local decisions can be made best affected by that.
Who has the absolute moral truth, though?
Well, I guess we all have our own. Asked that question of Jesus. It's the most famous question in the Bible right after "Hath God said?" So it's the number two lie of all time in creation, that you can't know truth. Our founding fathers said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. See, the problem, Ben, is we've reached an age in this empire that we have of America where people doubt that there is self-evident truth. And because of that doubt, that's the first crack in the foundation. Everything else springs from it. So you have to return to self-evident moral absolutes. If we talk about the science or the psychology behind this, every psychologist for the last 200 years since psychology was invented has said that homosexuality is a mental disorder. The Word of God says it's a mental disorder. It says you were given a sound mind, but in Romans it talks about homosexuality.
More recently, though, it's been removed as a mental disorder.
That's
a generation or two ago.
That's two wolves and a sheep voting on lunch. It doesn't make it right. Okay. I mean, I could put together a group of people right now who are my friends, and we could vote to say that, you know, radio talk show hosts are retarded. But you and I both know we're not.
Let's go to Suzanne, Craig, in Des Moines. Our time's running short.
Sure.
We have Craig Bergman with us for this first half hour, 1-866-780-9100. Post a message on our Facebook, if you like, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Suzanne in Des Moines. Hi, Suzanne. What's your point or your question?
Hi. Well, what I'd like to point out in this discussion is, certainly a lot of religions, they claim that, the problem I have with organized religion is that it claims the presumption of piety and ethics without it ever being questioned. And so when things happened in the Catholic Church and that, it was kind of in the background. There was just a presumption like, oh, that could never happen. It's piety. Well, all organized religions, no matter what culture, no matter where they came from, no matter what this man on your show believes, are tradition and culture. All religion, all organized religion is man-made tradition and culture, and so is the Boy Scouts. So the Boy Scouts have to determine what cultures and what traditions do we want to serve. I think homosexuality would best be respected as a religion. It doesn't matter whether you have a genetic propensity or not. It's a chosen practice. It's accepted by some people as ethical and moral. And that's what we have to decide. You know, I'm agnostic, and I think I'm, you know, one of the most ethical and moral people I know. People in organized religions, presumption of piety.
Okay.
It's misleading and judgmental, and it's not effective for general society.
Suzanne, thank you from Des Moines. Let's get a response, if you have one, Craig Bergman.
I do, actually. She makes a very good point. It's one of the things I've noted, especially in my dealings with folks who are atheistic or agnostic. You know, one of the campaigns that I worked on in my long resume there was I was national political director in 2007 and 2008 for Ron Paul, who has a slightly different, what I'm going to call north of center political position on a number of issues. And so I'm very familiar with that kind of argument. And it makes a good argument. I mean, the house is solid. Again, I think it's off the foundation only slightly in the fact that it comes from the position that says you can't know truth. And there are people who hold that position. I would say that you have to be able to know truth, because if you can't know truth, then all you have is force. When that decision comes down, and like she says, it's going to be made, and you have two opposing sides, if they do not have a common frame of reference and truth from which to reason together, then you will end up with force. We talk about that with the moral certitude in the war between the states.
Let me ask you this in the limited time we have,
sure.
Craig Bergman. There are, we'll throw this out because we're talking about, you know, one truth or religion. We looked, and there are denominations that are okay with the compromise floated by the Boy Scouts of America. The Southern Baptists, no on that. Catholics, we got no comment from. The Catholic Church, Mormons, no comment. Some Lutheran churches, though, are open to the proposed policy change. Some Jewish temples have come out against the current ban, wanting to change the policy. So we have a mixed bag when it comes to different denominations within Christianity or within Judaism. So how can we then say there is one moral truth, and if it should be decided on that?
That's well, I think you have to go. Yeah. You have to go right back to where I was in Corinthians. Corinth was a Christian church. It was one of the first Christian churches ever founded. Paul himself founded it. And within a couple of years, just a couple of years of the teachings of Christ through Paul, they had slipped into sexual immorality, and he had to rebuke them very, very strongly. The second letter to the Corinthians is not like the first letter. It's a harsh letter. And so I think that you're always going to have people who stray from the truth, and they need to be lovingly brought back to it.
We have listeners, certainly, who are non-Christians. Can you speak on their level without quoting Scripture as to why this should be so?
I would have to say our founding fathers, some of whom were deists, some of whom didn't have a modern 21st century eschatology that many conservative Christians have today, and they said truth was self-evident. Cicero, Plato, pagans said it was self-evident. So I think you can use reason to arrive at truth.
Okay.
And I would just say that. Can I plug one of our other websites?
Well, you can mention it. We don't. Yeah,
sure.
Go ahead. Sure. Quickly.
NoMoreWimpOuts.com is where we're addressing this Boy Scout issue.
Okay. Craig, times are changing. We see it in the headlines almost every week. The military now allows gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military. Why shouldn't the Boy Scouts of America have a standard like the military, changing with
That's
the times?
That's a great question. Number one, I would say changing with the times is irrelevant. Number two, I served in the military. I served when it was George Bush and Ronald Reagan's military. I did not serve after Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I resigned in 1992 because I knew what Bill Clinton was going to do to the armed forces, having been educated by my superiors who served in the Jimmy Carter era of the military. But I think the question is backwards. I think why should the Boy Scouts embrace the mistake that our military has now been forced to endure.
Mm-hmm. What is your organization, Patriots for Christ, and others like your organization affiliated with you going to do to mobilize in the run-up to this national meeting in May when the Boy Scouts of America will presumably vote one way or another? They will either keep the status quo, the ban stays as it is, they'll make that compromise, which was floated, each local chapter deciding for itself, or perhaps lift the ban completely. What is your organization doing? We have just a couple minutes left, so we'll have to hurry up here.
We have our website, No More Wimpouts. We're running national television. We have the Boy Scouts officers' telephone numbers listed for our supporters to call them and voice their opinion. But I think what it's really going to come down to is your very first caller who said, if they go this route, we're done. Mm-hmm. And I think they will see a reverse Chick-fil-A phenomenon. The Boy Scouts of America will have endured for its season, and as it was, it will be no more, and that will be sad.
Mm-hmm. Zach Walls says that the Boy Scouts, if they don't change, will become increasingly irrelevant in society because they aren't changing with its inclusiveness.
Well, I would rather be right than popular.
If the vote doesn't go the way you wish, keeping the status quo, will you accept it? Will you be willing to make that compromise?
Never.
Have a boy or nephew of yours in the Boy Scouts of America?
Never. I will speak out against it until I draw no more breath.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you have family? Do you have sons? Or
no, I am not married.
Okay. What if your son or your nephew were gay and wanted to join the Scouts, or son or nephew had all the requirements to be an Eagle Scout and then came out publicly as gay? Should that person be denied an Eagle Scout award?
I would say the same thing as if my son came out and said that he was going to commit any other sin. If he was going to be a thief, I would rebuke him. If he said he was going to be a drunkard, I would rebuke him. If he said he was going to be lazy or slothful, I would rebuke him.
Mm-hmm.
Sin is sin. Right is right. Wrong is wrong. And what the gay movement is trying to do is normalize sin. That's what I'm objecting to.
Craig Bergman, you live in Des Moines.
Yes.
Do you have any homosexuals or lesbians in your circle of friendship?
In my circle of friendship, no.
Okay, you don't. You don't run across them?
Oh, I run across them all the time. I'm in a Christian contemporary rock and roll band, so we play at all kinds of clubs and venues where multitude of people with a multitude of sins hang out.
Mm-hmm. So you believe in just not having contact, not having conversation with.
Oh, I have conversations with them all the time. I preach love and I preach truth.
Okay, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Your perspective, Craig Bergman, nationally syndicated radio talk show host of America's Wake Up Call and president of Patriots for Christ. Craig Bergman in our Des Moines studio. Thank you for coming in today, Craig.
It's been my pleasure, Ben, anytime.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about new research on where fear originates in the brain. We'll talk with a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist, Dr. John Wemmy of the University of Iowa, and talk about this little part of our brain called the amygdala. We'll find out what the amygdala does and what Dr. John Wemmy and his students have found out new about the amygdala when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally today, new research on the feelings you might have just sensed upon hearing this music from Psycho, fear and panic, where fear and panic originates in our brains, and how our brains might treat them differently than we previously understood. Joining me now, Dr. John Wemmy, a neuroscientist and associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and the Veterans Administration Hospital in our Iowa City studio, along with Colin Buzza, a medical student at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Glad to be here.
Earlier this month, gentlemen, Dr. Wemmy, you published this paper in the journal Nature Neuroscience, showing that the amygdala, we'll talk about that in a minute, a part of the brain, is not the only gatekeeper of fear in the human mind. Colin Buzza, you were a contributing author to the paper. A new study showing that different areas of the brain are responsible for different, for external versus internal threats. Let's boil that down in a minute, what you actually found out. But because the amygdala, part of our brain, is so central to our discussion, let's start there and tell us, what is the amygdala? Where is it located? What does it look like? What does it do?
Okay, so the amygdala is a small part of the brain. It's about the size of a thumb, the tip of your thumb. And we have two copies of an amygdala on each side of our brain. It's buried deep in the temporal lobe. Those are sort of the two arms that come out on the side of the brain that you see sometimes in pictures. And this structure, there's an awful lot of work in animals and humans and decades of research suggesting this structure is really, really critical for sensing or detecting or experiencing fear.
Experiencing fear of all types, going back to ancestors, fear of a wild animal, fear of an attack on your tribe.
That's a really good point. I think it's even goes farther back than that evolutionarily because, animals have very similar conservation in this structure from species to species. And its role seems to be very well conserved between species. So I think this is a very evolutionarily ancient structure that it's really critical for survival.
Not only mammals, but all other species as well have this same amygdala.
Not only mammals, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to ask, is there something equivalent in a fly or a worm? And I think because the architecture of those organisms is so different, hard to make that speculation.
Okay. We're getting off the track anyway. So let's talk a little bit about this experiment. And I understand with this experiment, you had some people participate who don't experience fear due to a damage to their amygdala. What sort of damage?
Colin, you want to take that one?
Yeah, so each of the three subjects that we tested has a damage to their amygdala on both sides due to a rare genetic condition called Urbach-Vitae disease. And so this is a disease that causes it's a mutation in an extracellular matrix protein that has mostly effects on the skin, but for unknown reasons it also causes destruction of that specific brain region, the amygdala, that's fairly selective for that region.
The effect being that these people have no sense of fear or?
Well, other researchers, largely here at the University of Iowa, have done a lot of work on studying this question. A lot of what we know about the amygdala in humans comes from research on one particular patient who's known as patient SM and who has this damage to her amygdala.
A patient that you know and have
that participated in our study.
Mm-hmm. So take us to this study, the basis of the new findings that are announced in this Nature Neuroscience article. What was the experiment that you did with these people who had damaged amygdala?
Right. So as we mentioned, people have had a lot of clues suggesting the amygdala is critical for fear and maybe panic. And there is a technique that's been used in psychiatric research to evoke panic attacks in people who are especially sensitive to panic attacks, like those with panic disorder. And this is inhalation of carbon dioxide, a single breath, deep inhalation of carbon dioxide. And most people who have panic disorder will have a panic attack if they inhale carbon dioxide.
Okay, this is of course deadly at a longer period. But
yeah, at very high concentrations.
So you put some in a chamber and subject them to CO2?
Actually, you put a mask on. Mm. And they take one very deep breath of CO2, and then we examine the effects of that.
Okay. What happens to a person without damaged amygdala? What would happen to me if I put this mask on and got that?
I mean, odds are, if you were to do it, you would probably experience some feelings of anxiety, but mostly you would have a strong respiratory drive and a feeling of air hunger.
I would immediately panic?
You probably would not panic unless you had panic disorder or a family history of panic disorder.
Okay.
But about 1 in 10 people who has no family history or no personal history will have a panic attack as well.
Okay. Now we take our subjects who have damaged amygdala and we compare their reaction to this. How do they react?
That's right. That's right. So we went into this with the hypothesis that they would be insensitive to this stimulus because so many other studies have suggested that they lack fear. And so the first patient came in, went through this protocol, took the CO2 inhalation, and immediately had a panic attack. And we were stunned because we were really expecting the opposite outcome.
Mm-hmm. That because they had this damaged amygdala, they would not register fear because they had, as we understood prior to this, no sort of fear indicator there too. So that happened the first time. Did that happen with other similar subjects?
We had three subjects that have similar damage, and it happened to all three of them, and it happened more than once to all three.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So now what we thought was true is no longer true. What do you think happened? What's going on? What have we misunderstood?
So, yeah, it's really interesting. To answer your question, what did we not know that we now know? That's going to take some time, and we have to think about that.
what could you surmise?
What it suggests at the very fundamental level is although the amygdala plays an important role in fear, it's not absolutely required for a panic attack. And even more than that, because there was a higher rate of these panic attacks in these special patients, it suggests maybe the amygdala has some role in inhibiting panic attacks. And that's sort of a new concept to consider. This area that has been thought to be really important in fear might actually play a role negatively regulating panic attacks, mm-hmm. which then, of course, suggests that maybe panic disorder, some similar sort of dysfunction could be potentially contributing to panic disorder. And that's where a new line of research begins.
I wonder if it says anything about the nature of fear. Fear is not fear. Or panic is not panic. We might learn to fear something because we might learn to fear dogs because we had a bad experience as a boy. So every time I would run into a dog after having a bad experience, I experienced fear. But initially, I did not have that. Now, the people with damaged amygdala with this syndrome, that opposed to a different type of fear where you're saying the CO2 in the air, where your body senses something organically, physically is not right. Those are two different types, right? Am I not using the right terminology?
Yeah, no, I think you're right on. We have others actually have been studying SM for years and patients like her, and all of these things that have failed to evoke fear-like responses have seemed to have been these extraceptive types of stimuli, things that rely on your vision or
things that we need to interpret. We need to
sense from the outside.
We need to recognize that is a spider, that is a snake, that is a wolf with fangs.
Things on the threats from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that may be different in considering, you know, what is it about this that's unique relative to these other kinds of stimuli is it is acting internally. Mm. We inhale it. It's a gas. It acts like, maybe a drug. And our ability to sense that as a threat, I think that this work is suggesting possibly those kinds of threats evoke fear through different mechanisms, through different pathways.
It's interesting. We're talking with Dr. John Wemmy, a neuroscientist, associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and the Veterans Administration Hospital in Iowa City, also with Colin Buzza. They've put out a paper in the journal Nature Neuroscience talking about how fear, panic is sort of cordoned off in our mind to trying to figure out what we understood about it and what this experiment they've been describing changes in our understanding of that. This is interesting. You have these test subjects, SM or MS?
SM.
SM. And So when this person was, as a subject, put on the mask and had a certain level of high levels of CO2 making them feel fear, they were previously people who had not felt fear when they saw, you know, from heights or snakes or Jack Nicholson in The Shining. They would not have felt fear. So was this perhaps the first time they felt fear?
Yeah, that's the implication. So we're trying to put ourselves in her shoes and experience what she's experienced without an amygdala and try to imagine what that's like. And this was the first time experimentally or in her life where she has expressed this kind of emotion.
Mm-hmm. What were her words? What did she say?
Well, she said... She described it as fear, and she described it as panic.
Actually, if you remember, her first word was help.
Yeah.
Help.
Yeah.
One syllable.
Yeah.
Help.
Help me. That's what she said.
I wonder if you interviewed her, if she related it to anything else she'd felt in life.
There was nothing comparable for any of these subjects. They had all said that the feeling that they experienced was completely novel.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from here with this knowledge? It sounds like this is an experiment that certainly surprised you, surprised the scientific community. Am I right? What is the reaction of the scientific community to this finding?
Yeah, I think there has been some surprise. I think it will shape how people think about the fear system and how it's probably a lot more complicated than being just a monolithic structure that's involved. And a number of researchers have sort of written about this and suspected it. But in humans, I think this may be one of the first clearest examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Go back and now say, with these findings, what will be done with these findings? What is the way you parse it into a new experiment or experiments to answer new questions based on these findings?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're asking it ourselves all the time. And so there are some important questions that follow. What brain structures do mediate this response? Does the amygdala really inhibit them? Can we demonstrate that more clearly? Can we find ways to do that? How is this actually related to panic disorder? Is this a key causative mechanism in panic disorder? And those are several important questions that we want to try to get at in the future.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, going back to your test subject, SM, or the other ones who had this disorder, mm-hmm. damaged amygdala, not feeling fear, to put it broadly. How does a person like that operate in life different than we do? Because fears are very useful things, aren't they?
That's a great question. And Colin, you and I were just talking about this yesterday. What do you think?
I mean, you know, it's interesting. These people, they have a normal intelligence. You know, they feel most of the same emotions we would otherwise feel. But it seems to be that they can intellectually learn about, so to avoid certain things. And if you ask them for advice on what are things that you should avoid and what are things that you could do, they would probably give you pretty good advice.
Probably to help people understand, I think, what we imagine this to be like is lacking that sort of gut feeling that you feel when you're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the conscious knowledge of knowing that something could be dangerous. It's just that little voice that says, you know, beware.
Right. So, okay, I'll go hike at Palisades Kepler here in Iowa, and I go up on that trail, and there's a cliff that would do me in if I fell over the cliff. So the person with this damage to their amygdala is approaching that cliff, and I get close to it, and I start feeling what you just described, Dr. Wemmy, right?
That's right.
I feel, it's a horrible feeling, and it ushers me away from that. That other person, SM, does what in that situation?
It seems like all three of these patients sort of lack that internal arousal sensation that, you know, they realize that the cliff is dangerous and that they could fall off it. But they just don't have that gut feeling that causes them mm-hmm. to be terrified of.
So they're, on the other hand, thinking just intellectually, I go to the cliff, I go fall off the cliff, I die without any feelings attached.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right,
mm-hmm.
Colin?
Yeah, without being sort of imbued with that, the emotional side of what most people would have in that situation.
I guess these people would all a whole genre of film, horror, would be wasted on that.
And researchers at the University of Iowa, like Justin Feinstein, who was a co-first author on this paper, has actually taken SM2 scary movies and to see what her response is like. And they haven't been able to scare her with those types of stimuli.
Nothing. Wow. Okay. I could come up with a short list very quickly.
Haunted houses, tarantulas, boa constrictors, all those things.
Dr. Wemmy, you work at the Veterans Administration Hospital with patients who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Let's talk a little bit about that. We've got a few minutes left. Remind us what that is, because we're
Post-traumatic stress disorder is an illness that occurs when someone has suffered a life-threatening threat or trauma, and the memory of this starts to permeate their future lives and interferes with their lives, disrupting their daily activities and their sleep and their relationships. And so this awful memory keeps intruding in their lives. And I think that's the essence of what we see with post-traumatic stress disorder.
And we hear it most in connection with our returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, but also from firefighters and first responders who come upon horrific events.
Car wrecks. And essentially anybody who has suffered a life-threatening trauma is potentially vulnerable to this problem.
Okay. Now, what are you doing in terms of research there for treatment of PTSD? Where have we made strides in the past few years?
So at the core, this is sort of a fear memory. And so thinking about fear and how it's recalled, and actually the role of the amygdala in this process has really dominated a lot of thinking about the neurobiological mechanisms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so I think that's one of the driving factors in our research, is trying to understand the amygdala and how it's influenced and what role it plays. And a lot of that is because of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. So have we learned anything that will help people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder recently that will help them?
You know, even our paper that we just published that we're talking about today is interesting, because these patients who were very vulnerable to carbon dioxide inhalation and had a panic attack, first time in their lives, and they admitted they felt afraid and panicked, but, you know, they were willing to do it again, and it didn't disrupt their thinking. And they had no problems trying this out again. So I think that also is telling us something about the amygdala.
And it's telling us something about the nature of fear, isn't it, Colin? Because we mentioned the horror film genre. We don't like being afraid, but then we do. We have a love-hate relationship with roller coasters, with the films that scare us.
Sure, and we wondered about that too, if there was a bit of that sort of novelty aspect that was driving them to be willing to do it again. But it actually seemed to be that they just didn't have sort of the emotional significance of what had happened to them. They didn't seem to carry that forward with them after the experiment.
What do you mean by that?
So sort of if they thought back on, I mean, if you had a frightening experience and you thought back on it, you know, you might have your heart might start racing. You might start breathing a little faster. You might start your
sweating.
Palms might sweat, and they could describe what had happened to them, but they wouldn't have that sort of reaction.
There wouldn't be a mini internal reenactment,
correct?
In their body, they wouldn't sort of play that loop again and again. That unfortunately, people who experience traumatic events do replay again and again, and can't get rid of it. And that's the essence of treating post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, that's right. So makes our work interesting to think about. On one hand, these cases lack a certain element of fear. On the other hand, they're especially vulnerable to it. So we've got our work cut out for us to figure out how there's this dual role being played by the amygdala.
Okay. What do you have on the immediate horizon that you want to look at? Colin, tell us, since you're a medical student, or either of you. We've got a few seconds.
Well,
left.
We've got opportunities to study this in humans who have brain lesions elsewhere, and we do an awful lot of research studying animals and mice, mm-hmm. and we can make genetic manipulations in mice, and we have a lot more power to investigate this in animal models like mice. And so I think for the next few years, a lot of our work is going to be trying to figure this out in animals.
Dr. John Wemmy, Colin Buzza, Dr. Wemmy, you described your work as interesting. I'm going to up that to incredibly fascinating, if you don't mind.
That's great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for coming in. Dr. John Wemmy, a neuroscientist and associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and the Veterans Administration Hospital. Colin Buzza, a medical student at the Carver College of Medicine at the University of Iowa. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. If you caught part of the program, you want to hear the whole thing, we always podcast these programs, put them on our archive, on our website forever, actually. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.